All right. I've got up on the map here what we have accomplished. We have read the letters to the church in Ephesus, Smyrna, Pergamum, Thyatira, and Sardis. And what we're going to cover tonight is we're going to finish up chapter 3, is my plan. And we'll talk about the church at Philadelphia and the church at Laodicea. A very interesting thing. It's a contrast. There are only two churches that did not receive criticism. One of them was Smyrna, and the other one is the one we're going to discuss tonight first, which is Philadelphia. I don't know what went into this, but these two churches were going to have very different experiences. If you remember when we talked about Smyrna, they got praised for their faithfulness, but they said, get ready, because really bad times are coming. And people are going to die. Philadelphia is in the middle of pagan idolatry. And you'll see, I'll put the slide up that gives a little history of it. There's so many pagan temples there. It was called Little Athens. That's not a compliment from our point of view. They might have thought it was. But what they're told is, there's bad times coming, but you all are going to get saved from it. Spared. Now, why did God choose to let Smyrna go through all this persecution when there was no criticism, and he chose to let the church at Philadelphia be spared from the persecution that was coming? And I have no idea why that was the case. But those are the only two churches that were not criticized. So anyway, now notice, while I got the map up here, notice Anatolia. Because Phrygia, you don't care about that yet, but I hope you will before we leave. Phrygia is in Anatolia. So just keep that in your brain. Okay, Philadelphia. Philadelphia was about 28 miles southeast of Sardis. It was a wealthy trade center. It was founded by King Attalus of Pergamum in 146 BC, and he loved his brother. His brother was dead. His brother was named Echimenes II, and King Attalus actually tacked on a suffix to his name. He was Attalus II Philadelphius, which means he was Attalus the brother lover. I don't know that I'm Bob Simpson, the Bill Lover. I guess I am. Wonder what he'd say. Anyway, he loved his brother Echimenes II so much that he named the city in his honor. So Philadelphia literally means brother loving. And of course, we got Philadelphia today, and their tourist enticement is the city of brotherly love. If you go up there and walk through the downtown streets of Philadelphia at night, you might find it's not the city of brotherly love. It's the city of, I've got a gun, give me your money. But there were so many pagan temples that the city was often called Little Athens. But there was also a very wealthy, beautiful synagogue in the city. Now, I find it interesting that this was a heavy earthquake area. Remember, it's Turkey now, but it's called Asia Minor back then. Philadelphia was destroyed by an earthquake in 17 AD, along with Sardis, which was, if you recall, just above it. Well, this tells you it was 28 miles northwest. The people lived in tents in the fields while they rebuilt the city with the help of the Roman Emperor Tiberius, and that's meaningful because what that means is they were in really good graces with the Roman pagan government. And after they rebuilt the city, then they moved out of the tents and moved back into it. So I thought, what's the best way to go through this? And I guess let's read through it quickly first, and then I'll go through the major, our pattern that we've gone through with it. What I don't comment on as I go through the pattern is how Jesus describes himself. But I think it's interesting for us to look at how he does that. We're in Revelation chapter 3, verse 7. And to the angel of the church in Philadelphia write, Jesus describing himself. He who is holy, obviously. He who is true, which means what he said was going to happen, happens. He who has the key of David. Okay, now a key symbolizes authority. And he has the authority that David talked about. And if you go back and look at Peter's sermon on the day of Pentecost, Acts 2, starting in around verse 30, he starts talking about the fact that David was promised that one of his descendants was going to be the Messiah. And so that's what Jesus is talking about here when he says he has the key of David. One who has the key is one who has the authority to lock and unlock. And that's the authority of David. He is the descendant of David. And he goes ahead and really kind of follows through with that idea in verse 7 when he says, who opens and no one will shut, and who shuts and no one opens. So what that means is absolute authority. When Jesus opens up something, there's nobody's going to shut it. And when Jesus shuts a door, it's going to stay closed. So that's the way he describes himself. Very interesting descriptors. I wish we had time. What I would do is compile a list of all the ways that Jesus described himself in the letters to these seven churches. Pretty interesting. Well, verse 8. I know your deeds, and that's that word again of all-encompassing knowledge. Behold, I've put before you an open door, which no one can shut. And remember, he's just described himself as, when I open a door, nobody's going to shut it. And when I close the door, nobody's going to open it. So he's telling the people here in Philadelphia, I have put before you an open door which no one can shut. Now, we don't know exactly what that means. There are two, I think, possibilities of it. And I'll tell you which one I prefer for no particular reason. But one of them is, I've opened a door of opportunity to you to preach the gospel to a receptive audience, to teach Christianity to people who will listen. I tend to think that's not it, although that does make sense. The one that I think it probably is, he says, I've put to you an open door of escape to the coming persecution. And that one is more logical to me, given what he says in the next few verses. So he says, I've put before you an open door, which no one can shut, because you have a little power, and you've kept my word and have not denied my name, because you have a little power. Now, what was their little power? Well, I don't think he's talking about the gospel there, because the gospel is big power. I don't think he would describe the power of the gospel as a little power. That would be big power. So I think he's probably talking about some type of political or socioeconomic power that the Christians in Philadelphia had, which is not made known to us. We don't know what it is. Now, some things happened there in Philadelphia that we're not told what they were, but it says they're going to happen. So what was it? Now, keep in mind, he said, I've opened this door to you, and I think it's the door of escape from the persecution that's coming, and you got a little power. There was some little power niche politically that they had, which God was going to take advantage of on their behalf to save them from the persecution or whatever bad thing was coming. So look at what he says in verse 9. Behold, I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan, and I think that refers to the actual synagogue. Remember, it was a very wealthy building there, a lot of money in this place. I will cause those of the synagogue of Satan who say that they are Jews and are not, but lie. Behold, I will make them to come and bow down at your feet and to know that I have loved you. So something politically was going to happen in Philadelphia, and there's no other discussion of what that is, and secular history doesn't tell us what that is. But, you know, there's millions of things that have happened in all kinds of biblical cities all over the place since they were created, and we don't know what they were, but God does. Well, in this case, he made something happen. And this synagogue of Satan, obviously, it's a bunch of Jews who were not, they were still claimed to be God's chosen people and how righteous they were and all that kind of stuff. But remember, as we said, spiritual Israel was destroyed when Jesus went to the cross, Colossians 2:14 tells us. And political Israel was destroyed in AD 70 by the Roman army when Jerusalem was destroyed. So there really was no such thing as Israel anymore. So these people were liars, frauds. I think they were actual Jews. But he calls them a synagogue of Satan. Where are we? Okay, and something happened politically. God made something happen in Philadelphia to where these Jews had to come and somehow grovel at the feet of the Christians. And I think it was some kind of a political thing. And it's kind of a teaser for us. I don't know what it was, but something happened. And he tells these people, these Christians in Philadelphia, you're going to dodge the bullet of this evil stuff that's coming along. I'm going to save you from it. Anybody have any comments about that? I mean, it's just enough information to make us really curious. What in the world happened? What was their little bit of power? And what happened that the Jews had to come to them? And I tend to think it was some kind of a political, socioeconomic thing that happened. All right, verse 10. Because you kept the word of my perseverance, I will also keep you from the hour of testing, that hour which is about to come upon the whole world to test those who dwell upon the earth. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about what this means in verse 10. I've got some of this on the overhead, but it says, you kept the word of my perseverance. Another word for that from the Greek word is endurance. Jesus obviously demonstrated endurance, and they took the example of his and followed it. You have kept the word of my endurance, my perseverance. They imitated what Jesus did. And he says, and here's where it says you're going to escape. I will keep you from the hour of testing. I'll tell you a little bit more about that testing in just a minute. But the hour of testing is a specified time limit. I mean, it's not an hour. It's not like there was going to be 1 hour of bad stuff happening. But it means it's a time interval with a beginning and an ending. It was not going to be permanent, but it's symbolic. And that hour which is to come upon the whole world, and that's to be understood as the known world of the Roman Empire, to test those who dwell upon the earth. As we go through the book of Revelation, what you're going to see is when it talks about those who dwell upon the earth, that tends to be those who have rejected Christ. It's the pagan idolatry people. Those are those who dwell on the earth. Christians are usually talked about in a different manner. And those who dwell on the earth are those who have rejected what Jesus has to offer. So it's coming. But verse 10 says, I'm going to keep you from the hour of testing. Whatever bad thing is going to happen, this church is going to be spared. Because they got that little bit of power. Don't you wish you knew what that was? And then he says, I'm coming quickly. Well, does that sound like Judgment Day? Well, it doesn't sound like Judgment Day to me, and I don't think it is. I'm coming quickly. Something was going to happen. And he says to them, hold fast what you have in order that no one take your crown. You're doing all the right stuff. Keep on doing it and hold fast to what you have so that nobody takes your crown. And that's the word Stephanos, which is the crown of victory that the winner in the games would win. And it says, don't let anyone take your crown. Now, does that sound to you like once saved, always saved? Well, the answer is no. Because it was possible they had their crown on because they were doing all the right stuff. And he says, hold fast to what you're doing so no one takes your crown. 12, he who overcomes, I will make him a pillar in the temple of my God, and he will not go out from it anymore. And I will write upon him the name of my God and the name of the city of my God, the New Jerusalem, which comes down out of heaven, my God and my new name. Now, all those things refer to heaven. And I'll make a case for that in just a minute. He who has an ear, let him hear what the Spirit says to the churches. So let's look at that a little bit in more detail. First of all, the praise. They kept his word. They did not deny the name of Jesus. Obviously under pressure. Because remember, this was Little Athens. So they had this similar pressure on them that the other Christians had in these other places with the idolatry. They kept the word of Jesus. This says perseverance. Barry's interlinear translation says endurance. Very similar words. They followed Jesus' example of endurance. What'd they do wrong? Nothing. I mean, obviously, they were human, so they made mistakes. But Jesus offers no criticism to them. The admonition, I'm coming quickly. Hold fast what you have in order that no one take your crown. Bad things are about to happen. Keep hanging on there. And if you do that, you're going to be spared. It's a nice promise. Okay, now let's talk about what he says is going to happen there in verse 12. All these things are talking about what's going to happen. They're referring to what's happening after judgment in heaven. I think it's clear. He who overcomes will be a pillar in the temple of God. Now somebody says, well, could that mean the church? Could that mean the church on earth? You know, we talk about somebody being the pillar of the community. Could that be a pillar of the temple of God? And I think not, because it says, he who overcomes be a pillar in the temple of God and will not go out from it. So whoever is that pillar in the temple of God will not be removed as a pillar. Well, you know, as Christians, people can lose their faith and quit the church. And if it's talking about being a pillar in the temple here, that pillar has been removed. So I think what we're talking about here is the temple of God as it is in heaven. And then it says, unto him will be written the name of my God, the name of the city of my God, the new Jerusalem, and my new name. So all those are wonderful things that are going to apply to these Christians in Philadelphia. The temple of God probably refers to the saved in heaven because they will not go out. It says they will be unmovable. Okay. Then the city of my God. If you go over and read chapter 21, verses 2 and 10, what you see is the city of my God is the New Jerusalem. And what that refers to is the saved in heaven. That's the New Jerusalem. Because if you read that chapter, it tells you that the elements have been destroyed. This order has been destroyed, but there is this New Jerusalem. And Revelation 21, 2 and 10, I wish we had time to read all these, but we don't, because we're racing the clock in the calendar. But I think you can see, if you read that, it makes a good case for the fact that that's in heaven. The name of my God. Well, whenever I got a new basketball, the first thing I did when I was a kid was I wrote my name on it. What does that mean? This basketball belongs to me. Well, what does it mean that they're going to have the name of God on them? They belong to God. It also says they're going to have my new name. And that indicates that they belong to Jesus. And later on in Revelation, it talks about his new name. But we're going to share in that new name. So I think everything we're talking about here is people who are saved. They're going to be pillars in the temple in heaven. They'll have God's ownership. They'll have Jesus' ownership, and they'll be unmovable. Their salvation is locked in. Anybody have any comments or questions about that? Okay. I feel guilty every time y'all don't say anything after my lecture at you on talking too much about Ephesians. And ever since then, mum's the word in here. But that's okay. I'll deal with my guilt. Okay, what's next is, let's go over the details of this. Starting with verse 8, talked about the open door. And I mentioned there are two possible interpretations of that. Number one is, I think, logical, but I don't think it's the one, the open door. And number two, I think, is the one. And that's the door is open for them to escape the coming trials because of this little bit of political power that they had. The synagogue of Satan probably refers to an actual synagogue in which people who claim to be Jews practiced evil. And in some way that we don't know, they were going to have to submit to Christians somehow. And I think it was probably a political submission. Or could it be that they were going to be forced to acknowledge Jesus as the Messiah? I tend to think that probably is not the case. They seem to be hardcore resistant. So I think it's probably talking about some kind of political thing. Now let's look at the trials that it's talking about in verse 10. Verse 10 in the New American Standard talks about the hour of testing. And that testing, your version might have trial in there. And that comes from the Greek word parasmos. I don't know if I'm saying that correctly or not. But in Barry's Interlinear, he translates that as trial. And Vine defines that as trials with a beneficial purpose. So it was going to be something they were going to have to endure. And if they endured it properly, it was going to be to their advantage. The word could also include temptations. Well, you can see how that might be a factor back then. A temptation can be a trial if the temptation is to give up Jesus and to go with idolatry. The trials are not specified, but whatever it was, the church is going to be protected. That had to be comforting to them. So whatever was going to happen was going to happen soon. This is not way off into the future. It's going to happen sometime relatively soon. Okay. Laodicea. Laodicea was a disaster. But you recall when I told you that some people say that these churches are just representative, unreal churches that represent congregations of various conditions. And this one is one that tells me that that's not the case. Because I'm going to tell you some stuff that I find so interesting about Laodicea, that this place actually existed. Well, I mean, obviously there was a city called Laodicea, but there's some other things about it. Laodicea was 40 miles southeast of Philadelphia. So as we go around the clock of the seven churches, we're down around 5 o'clock, and it's the last letter that's written. It was 11 miles west of Colossae. And of course, Paul wrote a letter to the Colossians around 62 AD, scholars think. And it was 6 miles south of Hierapolis. And you say, well, I never heard of Hierapolis. Well, yes, you have. If you've read the book of Colossians, you've heard about Hierapolis. Laodicea and Hierapolis are both mentioned in Colossians. So let's go over there for a minute to Colossians chapter 4 and see what it says, because this is interesting. Now, we're talking about Laodicea, but Laodicea is mentioned 2 or 3 times in Colossians chapter 4. First of all, let's start with verse 13. Well, let's start with verse 12, because the subject of this is Epaphras. Epaphras, who is one of your number, this is in Colossae now, a bondslave of Jesus Christ, sends you his greetings, always laboring earnestly for you in his prayers, that you may stand perfect and fully assured in all the will of God. For I bear him witness that he has a deep concern for you and for those who are in Laodicea and Hierapolis. Okay. Luke, the beloved physician, sends you his greetings. And also Demas. Clearly this was, unless it's a different Demas, it's before Demas forsook him. 15. Greet the brethren who are in Laodicea. And also Nympha is a woman, and the church that is in her house. And when this letter is read among you, the one I'm writing to you, Colossians, have it also read in the church of the Laodiceans, and you, for your part, read my letter that is coming from Laodicea. It's a very interesting verse, because this makes some scholars believe that Paul wrote a letter to the Laodiceans, and we don't have it. I don't know. But anyway, clearly Laodicea was doing well enough that Paul sends them some greetings and doesn't offer any criticism of the church in Laodicea, and even talks about this lady in whose house the church was meeting. Okay, now Paul's letter to Colossians, most people think, was written around 61 to 62 AD. And this is another one of those little reasons. It's not a compelling reason, but it's another little reason that makes me support the later date Remember, there are some people who think it was written between 64 and 68 AD during Nero's reign, and other people think it was written between 94 and 96 AD, Domitian's reign. Now think about this. If it were written between 64 and 68 AD, and Paul wrote this letter to the Colossians in 61 or 62, then the church at Laodicea fell apart in 3 to 4 years. Totally. He had nothing good to say about them. I mean, they were a mess. We'll get to see. This was the worst one, I think, probably, of any of them. So that makes me think they had to have some time to fall apart, spiritually deteriorate. And that's another thing that pushes me to go with the later date. Anybody want to comment about that?
I had been discussing it with a friend of mine in Birmingham about what we've been studying. He mentioned one thing about if John wrote it in the 90s, how old would he have been?
Old.
Very old.
Old as you.
Disregarding that, the Holy Spirit was involved, so he could have, what the Lord was telling John, he could have.
Yeah, scholars tend to think that John got out of Patmos around 96, went back and finished out his life at Ephesus, and died after only a few years back at Ephesus. But that doesn't make him 150. Well, yeah, he was walking with Jesus in the 30s. And how old would he have been then? You know, I would say he was probably 20 or 25. I mean, like, we're just speculating a little bit. So that would mean John was born, if he's walking with Jesus in the 30s, John was born around 15 A.D. And if he wrote this in 96, that makes him 81 when it was written. How old are you?
Older than that.
There you go. I bet you could still write a mean book.
One or two pages.
Yeah. Okay.
Is there any reference to the destruction of Jerusalem? Is there anything that could be interpreted as the destruction of Jerusalem? Because if it was before 70 AD, then there would be no reference. Doesn't mean that, you know, if there isn't one, then it couldn't be written.
Well, there's all kinds of talk about Israel and Jerusalem all through Revelation, but it's always in the spiritual. And you know, what does the New Testament say Christians are with regard to Israel? Who is spiritual Israel? Well, that's you and me. And so the New Jerusalem is the spiritual Jerusalem. And spiritual Israel is the church. So, now it does make a difference if you're one of the early people or late people, because if you're one of the early people, then you see a lot, you interpret a lot of this stuff as meaning the destruction of Jerusalem. I don't think that makes nearly as much sense as it happened later. Okay, Laodicea. 45 miles southeast of Philadelphia, 11 miles west of Colossae, and we mentioned it. That Laodicea and Hierapolis are mentioned in Colossians 4:13. Antiochus II was a Greek king who really loved his wife, whose name was Laodicea. So he named the city after her, Laodicea. It was an extremely wealthy banking center. Living was easy. Many people in this city were affluent. I mean, really affluent. A lot of rich people. Very easy lifestyle. And it was a center of imperial worship. Now, here's something that is really interesting. 11 miles from the city of Laodicea was a medical school. And one of the first medical books written was by an ophthalmologist. I don't know how much ophthalmologists knew back in 96 AD. A guy with a Greek name who I've read, but I didn't write it down. Anyway, he wrote a book on treatment of the eyes. Okay, there was a medical school there, and they came up with something called Phrygian ointment. Remember when I asked you to remember Anatolia? Phrygia was a region in Anatolia. and there were some stones there. Very similar in nature to pumice. If y'all ever seen any pumice, it breaks up easily, easily becomes a powder. Well, this stone in Phrygia was broken up, and then somehow they mixed oil with it, somehow, and it became an eye salve, and it was called Phrygian ointment. Now, when you get home, if you want to, if you're having trouble sleeping, just type in Phrygian ointment in your computer, and lots of references are going to pop up about this eye salve that was developed at the medical school in Laodicea. Very interesting stuff. So they sold it. We don't know what the recipe was for it. But sometimes it's called Phrygian powder. Sometimes it's called Phrygian ointment. And Jeff, I guess there's all kinds of medications that you sell. Some of them are in powder form. Some of them are in ointment form. You don't have any Phrygian ointment on the shelf? Okay. Another good thing, interesting thing about Laodicea is they cultivated a certain breed of sheep that produced black wool instead of white wool. And it became, because it was rare, it became very expensive. So they made garments out of it and sold it around the place. So you can see they were making money hand over fist over all kinds of stuff. They were selling eye salve. They were selling garments made out of black wool and all this kind of stuff. However, they had a problem. The water in Laodicea was notoriously undrinkable. Colossae got their water from a cold stream, which apparently was pure at the source. Hierapolis got their water from hot springs, which apparently was pure at the source. But what Laodicea did was they decided to import their water from Hierapolis through aqueducts. And the aqueducts, remember, look at the top. Colossae and Hierapolis were 6 miles apart. So we got 6 miles worth of aqueducts where the water is coming from Colossae down, from Hierapolis. Yes, it's 5 or 6 miles through aqueducts. Well, when it reached Laodicea, the water that was once hot became lukewarm, and it tended to produce nausea and vomiting. Now, do those things ring a bell? Well, let's see. Letter to the church at Laodicea, praise, none. Criticism, because they were neither hot, cold, nor hot. Wow, they had their choice between water from the cold spring and water from the hot spring, and they chose the hot spring, but by the time it traveled 5 miles down the aqueduct, it was lukewarm, and the word that's translated lukewarm means induces vomiting. It was lukewarm, and what did Jesus say he was going to do with them? He was going to emeo them. And emeo is the Greek word for vomit. I guess some translations, to be civilized, put the words, I'm going to spit you out. But it's worse than that. Oh, boy. Okay. Well, I'll hurry. Got 5 minutes. Now, it says he's going to spit them out of their mouth. They viewed themselves as rich, in need of nothing. But spiritually, Jesus says, you're wretched, you're miserable, you're poor, you're blind, you're naked. And what's even worse, you don't even know it. Admonition, buy from Jesus spiritual gold refined by fire. And if you read 1 Peter 1:7, he talks about that gold refined by fire is proof of the genuineness of your faith. He wanted them to become spiritually rich instead of materially rich. He wanted them to clothe themselves with white, pure garments as opposed to black wool, to cover the shame of their spiritual nakedness, and to use eye salve that they may see. Now, you tell me that Jesus wasn't using a little play on words here about the fact that this Phrygian powder was developed in Laodicea? I think he certainly was. And he says, you need to use this eye salve, obviously spiritual eye salve, be zealous and repent. So possibly the white garments contrast with the black wool. And then it says, he who overcomes will sit with Jesus on the throne, and Jesus will knock at the door and dine with him who opens it. Now, the relationship between us and Jesus is reciprocal. Let's look at that verse. Verse 21 of chapter 3. He who overcomes, I will grant him to sit down with me on my throne. No, I want 20. Behold, I stand at the door and knock. If anyone hears my voice and opens the door. This is what you all and I have with Jesus is a reciprocal relationship. He is knocking on our door, but we got to open it. Okay, there's a second reciprocal relationship here. I will come into him and will dine with him and he with me. Well, back then, dining was seen with each other, was seen as a very intimate relationship. And Jesus says, I will dine with him and he will dine with me. Once again, emphasizing the reciprocal nature of the relationship between Christians and Jesus. He's going to bring the food over and offer it, but we got to dine with him like he's dining with us. He's going to knock on the door, but we got to open it. So that's what he's saying to them. And so he says, he who overcomes, I'll grant to him to sit down with me on my throne. I also overcame and sat down with my Father on the throne. So I've given you the gist of it here, I believe. But we'll read it till the bell rings. And so I'm going to consider Laodicea done. So whoever's up here next week, whether it's me or somebody else or nobody, we're ready to start Revelation chapter 4 and to get into the really heavy symbolic stuff. Appreciate your attention.